political life. That is, for most of my life, except the first part of it, so far as I can figure out now, all I was interested in was in trying to be an athlete and trying to wow the women. And I don't know whether I failed in that or succeeded, but in any rate, at some point along the line, I figured that it wasn't worth it. And I don't know whether I figured it wasn't worth it because I couldn't make it, or whether I figured it wasn't worth it, and then I didn't think it was important to make it. I grew up a Methodist, and if you know anything about Methodists, you know why I am in part what I am. The Methodist thinks that you should really love God and your neighbor, and I think the only difference between the Methodists and the Lutherans is that the Methodists think you can. So I grew up with the notion that it was not too difficult to love God and your neighbor, and with a little bit of education, a little bit of just calling attention to the good people of the world, Methodists and others, to the problems, they would take care of themselves. Now, somewhere along the line, I'm not quite sure, I hit the doctrine of sin. It must have been in my Methodist upbringing, but it didn't really hit me until I hit Luther and Reinhold Niebuhr. And after I hit Luther and Reinhold Niebuhr, I wasn't sure that there was any possibility of doing any good. But I did really, I think, understand or feel the importance and the meaning of the doctrine of justification by grace through faith. And I don't know how it came to me. I know I read a lot of Luther. I plowed through that commentary on the Epistle of Galatians, which you must see 1,000 pages or more. And while it's talking chiefly about the sin of the Catholic Church and its doctrine of justification by religious works, the message got clear to me that I was never going to be able to justify myself by my works. And the meaning of that for me was that I was never going to know enough or be virtuous enough, and no one else was going to know enough or be virtuous enough to bring in the kingdom of God in this world. See, Methodism thought the kingdom was coming, it was important to bring it, and you could bring it. But what I learned from this doctrine, that was nobody was going to bring it. Nobody was good enough, and nobody was knowledgeable enough. And still, since I was a Methodist, I thought you ought to try to do it. Now, I often say to young people today, the problem with you is you never had any Methodist illusions. If you'd grown up with the illusions, you could become a little realistic, and you'd still have the illusions in your blood, so you'd still try. But if you're brought up only on the doctrine of sin, really, and that justification is by God's act and not your act, sometimes you despair of what is possible. That notion, then, that one ought to love his neighbor and God, but that one didn't have the knowledge and the virtue to love his neighbor and his God the way he should, provided then the background for my social philosophy. And I want to try to use those two principles, what I call after Tillich, the Protestant principle and the Catholic substance. If you take the notion of the kingdom of God coming in history and above history, and the notion of the Protestant principle and the Catholic substance, you can get a social philosophy. And I want to point out what that means. The notion of justification by grace through faith means, since no one is good, everybody ought to have a chance to be bad. Since no one is good, everyone ought to have a chance to be bad, equal chance to be bad. So the doctrine of equality of opportunity as a social philosophy follows from the notion that everybody is a sinner and everybody then ought to have a chance to sin in his own way. Now what followed from that was democracy as a social philosophy, as a political philosophy, and laissez-faire economics as an economic philosophy. Namely, everyone ought to have a chance, equal chance, to initiate in economics, to do what he pleased, as long as it didn't interfere with others. Everybody ought to have a vote. Everybody ought to have a chance to initiate politically. Now, the problem that we have is that there's some who never have had a chance to initiate. So the first revolution is to take the doctrine of justification by grace through faith seriously, and the implication that stands behind that, or the presupposition that stands behind that, namely that all men are sinners. And if all men are sinners, all men distort the truth, all men distort their virtue, all men think they know what is good for each other when they don't, all men think they act, all men, I should say all persons. In our little ritual at home in the Missouri Synod Church where Sarah and I go, all the word, whenever they say man, you know, in some ritual, they put person there now. I mean, it's all written over. Somebody, you know, I can't imagine, must have been some man went through and put person every place that there was man. But at any rate, now there are four groups in this country, I think, who have been excluded. I've spent about 7 years in the ghetto. And it's obvious, I think, to anybody who has ever thought about it or experienced it, that black people have been almost completely excluded from American life for centuries. And the only reason we now know it is they no longer will take it. Thanks be to God. It seems to me that on the basis of the doctrine of justification by grace through faith, we ought to encourage black power. And I once gave a talk, it was a little bit idolatrous, Black Power, the Hope of America. But it's so true as over against what most of us believe that the idolatry can, you know, it can stand. It's like Jesse Jackson's new organization, PUSH, which is People Organized to Save Humanity. PUSH, People United. People United to Save Humanity. I told him, I said, that's a little idolatrous. You know, God is going to do the saving ultimately, not you. But he said, well, he said, that's true. But, no, for practical reasons. So for practical reasons, I'd say, the notion that black power is the hope of America is not a bad slogan. For if something isn't done for black people, they will split America and so disorganize America that there's a sense in which the unity, the belief in law and order and justice, which holds America together, will be dead. Now, it's easier for us to see the problem, I think, with black people than it is, and I use black here to symbolize non-white, it's easier for people to see this than it is to see the problem of the revolution of the powerless that our youth, for youth are in the same boat. For some reason in this country, we preserve adolescence into infinity. You're 30 before you're supposed to do anything, and where in many societies, a 13-year-old becomes a person, in our society, you're 30. The faculty in the divinity school won't even let students discuss who should be admitted to the school. And as I say, the students in the school are an average age of 26 with half a kid and three quarters of a wife, if you take it statistically. But they are not treated as mature enough and concerned enough with the life of the school to even read the applications and make some judgment about whether this is a viable student. Now, the youth of this country are in the same boat. Now, we have given 18-year-olds a vote. We sent them to war. We finally gave them a vote. Now, it's that kind of thing that I have in mind, that young people are in the same boat for one reason or another. And women, no, I really don't have to talk about that because we're going to talk about that tonight. But when you think about equality, what has equality been about equality in the early stages of America was equality for those who had property. Those who had property could vote. And gradually we extended the voting. But in extending the voting, we have not extended personhood. So that, as I say, the old, the white, the rich, and the men run everything. The old, the white, the rich, and the men run everything. And they run over everybody else if they can. They try to run over everybody in the world, as a matter of fact. And it's phenomenal when you begin to think about what white European civilization has done in the world, in the colonial empire. It is, you don't think about it sometimes, but when you think of the kind of domination that occurred on the part of European white people, well, the old, the white, the rich, and the men have done some very good things. Very good things. But the seasonal relevance of their power is at best questionable. Since they make all the important decisions, they are responsible for whatever trouble we have. And I think we're in some real trouble. I don't want to take the time to develop that. But we might want to discuss it, because sometimes I think that we theologians, not Lutheran theologians, but most of the rest of the theologians, are professional pessimists. We're almost paid to be pessimistic about things, so we think there's something we ought to be doing in the world. You know, something that ought to be done, therefore we have an important role. But sometimes it's very pessimistic. So I don't want to be classified as one of these professional pessimists, but I think it's not too far from the truth sometimes. Now, if it weren't for our trouble, however, we might not raise such serious questions about the old, the white, the rich, and the men. I have no simple kind of notion that because people are young and non-white and female and poor, that they'll do any better with the world than we old, white, rich men have done. But since things are in some trouble, and since I really believe, I guess, that if you don't have the right to participate, the knowledge, the education, the opportunity to serve any role in this society, you're not a person. You don't have that right. You might not choose it, but you ought to have the right. It's like saying, well, why do the blacks want to get in this mess we've made? That's all right for us to say. But I spent 7 years trying to get them in the mess. And I still think it's important to give people an opportunity to choose whether or not they want to be in the mess. That is what it means to be a person, is to be able to choose. Now, the least we can be for, it seems to me, and sometimes I think the only thing we know to be for, is radical control, a radical change in the control of America. And that really means sharing control in America with women, non-white, young, and the poor. Now, I really, as I said before, don't have a great deal of faith simply in sharing power. In the emotional aftermath of King's death, our students and faculty thought it'd be wonderful for us to do something significant. And so they gave me half-time off for 1 year, and I organized a group to try to deal with racism among whites. And in some great romantic blow, I gave power to all the staff. I hired all the staff, 6 people myself. I gave complete power to the seven of us. They made all the decisions about how much money you get. Well, that really, I think, in retrospect, was a fairly sentimental job. Before we were over, the organization was dead and I was out. And well, what happened, you see, was everybody had something special he wanted to do, and so he bargained with somebody else. If they would vote for what he wanted to do, then they would vote for what he wanted to do. And so we went in every direction and hence in no direction. So I'm very wary. I'm not a Democrat with a small D, really. But nevertheless, you see, we need a revolution, because the least we have to do is give all people a chance to participate in the decision making. I do believe that a radical change in power is necessary, partly because I think, you know, this is necessary in principle, but partly because I hope, and I think maybe it's a pious hope, that some of these people would do better than we old white, not so rich, I'm thinking about myself, old white, old white male, that's right. Now that brings up the second revolution, and this is what I've been concerned about, I think primarily for about 25 years, but I haven't known what to do about it, and sometimes I think I got in the black movement, and I was in the black movement, I was kind of the administrator for Al Raby, and then for Al Raby and Martin Luther King when he came to Chicago, and then for Jesse Jackson, although there were two or three of us who were working with him. So, but really, it was a serious business, and we were out after black power, and we got some. I happened to be a business agent for 60 black contractors, and I suppose I got $25 million worth of business for them in the course of the 5 years, and, you know, did all kinds of things with the power structure of Chicago because we had a little power. But I'm not talking about something that's just kind of on the side. It was a serious business. But really, I think I did it because I didn't know what else to do. What I mean to say is that I'm really convinced that the faith of America is in our capacity to produce and to control. To produce and to control. And many still believe that all our problems will be solved if we can increase control or increase our capacity to produce. Or they believe in the knowledge, getting knowledge, because they believe that somehow, if we have more knowledge, it's going to serve our capacity to produce and to control, and somehow that's going to liberate us. Now, some, I think, really believe that that will liberate us. I think some really believe that if we had more knowledge of what's going on in our cities, we could know what to do. Or if we had more knowledge of the human personality, some more personality psychology, people would be healthy. I don't believe that. But some do. I mean, I want to take them seriously. But others, I believe, have forgotten liberation and worship production and control. Meaning is found in producing anything and in controlling everything. And we do believe that our reason will discover a means to do whatever we choose to do, and I particularly want to emphasize that in the light of the ecological, so-called ecological crisis. We believe that our reason will discover whatever we need to discover. If we choose to do anything, we have the capacity to do it. And they really believe, I think, if we have the capacity, we ought to do it. So if we can go to Mars, we ought to go to Mars. And we could go to Mars. I'm convinced we can go to Mars. And unless something occurs, we'll go to Mars. And if we don't go to Mars because we think we ought to go to Mars, if we can, we'll go to Mars in order to be there before the Russians. We do not determine our decisions by any sense of what's important. Recently, Len O'Connor stated the case in discussing three tall buildings in Chicago. Big John, that's John Hancock Building. Big Stan, that's the Standard Oil, and Big Sears. He said, tall is good, taller is better, and I am Len O'Connor. You know Len O'Connor, he always closes, and I am Len O'Connor. Tall is good and taller is better. You know, the new buildings are way up above John Hancock now. Our life there is dominated by these institutions that are able to produce and control, or adjuncts to production and control, and by those men who have the techniques for production. Now, I really believe, in a sense, that McNamara was made, he was Defense Department. He was made head of the Defense Department because he could understand and computerize the whole operation. And that's what he did. And nobody who couldn't computerize it could have been made head. And that's increasingly true. If you can computerize something, you're likely to get in an important spot, because if you can't understand the computer, you really have to depend on somebody else, and that's not a very good situation to be in. Meaning in the sense of well-being, therefore, depend upon a continual rise in the gross national product. Now, I'm not against the rise in the product, but it seems to me there's no consideration of what the product is, or very little, but it's in increasing the gross national product. And you measure that and you compare it with Russia, and that becomes kind of a standard of well-being for a country. And of course, in the technological competence that assures this continued increase. Personal meaning then follows from one's role in production or control, and from the fact that one is in a country where we have high production. Personal meaning is found in our mastery of something needed in production or control. Now, the product, I think, is anything that's exchangeable. That is, anything that's saleable, or that demonstrates our capacity to produce or to control. That is, the trip to the moon, in a sense, is a very good product because it demonstrates that we can go to the moon. And part of the meaning is that it demonstrates we can go to the moon. Now, I don't know really what we're learning about going to the moon, learning from going to the moon, or how important it is, particularly, I understand, to send men to the moon, because you could do almost all the things you do without sending men to the moon with about, very small percentage of the cost, I'm told. But it's important to send men to the moon, because the Russians have sent machines to the moon, and we're the only ones who send men to the moon. I caricature a little, But it's the principle is what I'm concerned about. What is it that we worship in this country? I don't really know what the meaning of consumption is. Some claim that we consume in order to prove that we have produced. So conspicuous consumption provides status in being a sign that we can produce. On the other hand, consumption may well fill the vacuum left by one's sense of the meaninglessness of production. That is to say, you may consume because there's no meaning in production, but there's a little meaning in consuming, and having nice things and going places and doing things. I find that meaning myself. If I can't find anything else to do frequently, as I say, Sarah and I will go out. We don't go out often, and she says she always feels bad when we spend money, but nevertheless, I get some satisfaction, and I can only speak for myself, in buying things, just going out and buying things. It's all afternoon, maybe, to buy one dress or one, if you're careful and you go there and shop, and you get just what you want, you come home with some satisfaction, or you come home with frustration if you don't. But at any rate, there's some meaning in it. If one does not enjoy his work, he may at least secure the means to consume conspicuously. Now, I don't think there's any doubt some of us are caught in this vicious circle. We consume a lot, which means we work a lot and have no time to do what might provide a meaning if we knew what then to do. So in some sense, I don't know what we would do if we didn't have to work a lot. So if we could reduce the necessity to consume, we'd have a lot of time. And then we'd have to figure out what to do with that time. And I'm not convinced that's a simple thing. There's a book on, Working Class Society, which shows that the average television watching in that community is 17 hours a week. That's the average, children and adults. So I'm not quite sure what we would do, what the alternatives are. At any rate, what I'm trying to say is, first I was interested in process, the revolution in process, who controls. Now I'm concerned with what it is we control, what is the substance. For I'm convinced it is an, It isn't sufficient, and I really have trouble with all the people who are talking about participatory democracies, that somehow if you got people to participate, you're going to solve the problem. I don't believe it for a minute. The question is, what do they want to do with whatever power they have? And I think the old faith seems very questionable. And I really am convinced that what we are in is a situation in which we produce things that are important, but we produce way beyond what we have to in order to live well. And so we have to spend our time, we have to consume in order to keep that production going. Actually, it's a very vicious circle. If we don't consume, then the production will be in problem. I think that's good economics. If we don't consume and take the product off, and there are big inventories, then the production will stop, and then the work will stop, and then there will be unemployment. Is that correct economics? You don't think that will happen?
Well, yeah, in the first one, yeah, most economists agree. That's certainly the opposite.
At any rate, we are taught, regardless of what the fact is, we are taught that we got to consume in order to keep production going. So there's a real reason for consuming. Whether that is true or not, I feel it's true, because that's what I've been taught. Now maybe we could have a new doctrine. The old faith seems questionable then to me, namely that seems to me emphasizes our role and performance in producing something. And that the important thing is to be able to do something important in a productive enterprise. And the production is for the sake, really, of production, I think, and not for the sake of consumption. It is really to keep, as I see it, it is to, if you look at the executive kind of mentality, and I don't have any hang-up with business as business like I used to do, because I realize that we're all hung up, and it's not more or less, it's a question of the values of all of us, because if we didn't consume, there wouldn't be the production. And we have a choice of consuming. Now, we have a choice, really, but I think we've been so socialized by our culture that we don't have a choice, because we really feel, and Marcuse says that actually our wants for things are biological. Now, that's using biological in a very loose way, but in a sense, we've been so socialized that it's not a matter of choice anymore. You simply don't feel comfortable in many instances. Now, I realize I'm talking to some of you that think you've broke through that. I think you think you've broken through that. But in a sense, many of us who've broken through have broken through negatively. We'll be damned if we're going to do what other people do, but we haven't broken through because we have an alternative. We have a negative kind of reaction to this. And so we go around in the oldest things we can find and without any concern, because we'll be damned if we'll have conspicuous consumption. So what I say we have conspicuous underconsumption. We really do. We are free to consume or not to consume because we have reacted so negatively. It's like saying you're free from your parents. But you never get free from them in some sense. You can be free from them in the sense you don't do what they say, but in one sense you're reacting negatively. At least I was always reacting negatively against my mother. If she said it, I was against it. I really was. And I wasn't free from her because I never agreed with her, because I'd always be on the other side, even if she were right. I think that in some sense, what I'm trying to say is that we are caught in a culture where the cultural gods are demonic or idolatrous, and they don't really serve love. That is, they don't serve to unite us. They serve to divide us, and they serve to prevent us from having the time to actually have to face what we ought to be about. So I think the goal of our culture is really products and power. Now, the content of a new faith is not very easy to portray. And I can use a lot of words, but I don't know exactly what they mean concretely as over against production of anything. It's production for use. As over against competition, it's cooperation or mutuality. As over against instrumental truth, it's truth as an end in itself. As over against the kind of getting ahead, it's for oneself, it's a concern with the community, it's a concern with interrelatedness, and it's a concern with enjoyment. I really think that a good part of the doctrine of the Protestant doctrine, the Protestant law, has said you ought not to enjoy life, because I know that was my mother. You ought not to enjoy life because you ought to be working. And she really thought if I enjoyed things and wasn't working on my grades, I know that always bugged me, that I ought to be studying, you know, and or working for my father. And if I enjoyed life, there was something wrong with it. Now, I think part of that has been a necessity in our culture, because if everybody followed his concern to enjoy life, we wouldn't have done the work. But now you see, I follow Marcuse here, who says you don't have to do the work, because we don't need what we're producing. So you could enjoy life, but if you enjoyed life very much, then you'd interfere with this productive enterprise. That's his theory. Whether it's right or wrong, I kind of buy it, because I want to buy it, I guess. I want to find somebody responsible for the mess we're in, that I think we're in. At any rate, I think these two revolutions are necessary. And I really think by far the most important revolution is not the revolution in control, but the revolution or process, but the revolution in substance. And you really have a problem trying to bring this off. You can withdraw into a kind of commune and try it, and I'm all for that kind of thing. But you're part of a whole culture. And until the whole culture somehow changes, I don't know what you do. And I don't know anywhere in the world where anything significant is happening, except with the possible exception of China. And I know so little about China that I can assert that something is happening there. If I knew what was happening there, I probably wouldn't be so eager. I know practically nothing except what I've read of Mao, because my students forced me into reading it, because they wanted to read it, and I felt that if they're going to read it and know about it, that I ought to know a little about it too. So I've been taking a reading course from my students. There are a couple of Chinese students, and it was fantastic. This one Chinese gal came into a course on religion and race. Can you imagine why she would ever come into a course on religion and race? And she's from Korea. She's got some problems. I mean, we were talking about black. That's what we were talking about. And we weren't talking about, we could have been talking about maybe, but so I said, all right, what are you about? I mean, where are you going to live? Well, she's either going to live in Taiwan or Korea. I said, well, I said, you know, wherever you're going to live over there, you're going to be under the domination of China. I mean, that's the facts of life. Another fellow from Hong Kong, and he didn't know what to do, so I said, the least you've got to know is understand what's going on and what it is you're addressing with your Christian faith. What's going on? So they started reading Mao, and I started reading with them, because one girl was actually afraid to take a course in the revolution, because some students from Korea had gone to Germany and gotten involved in studying Marxism and some other things, and they'd been sent for and brought home and beheaded. And she had a kind of anxiety about being publicly in a course. So you can understand why I'm studying Mao in that kind of situation. You're forced kind of into it by having these students. What I'm trying to say is that there's no simple kind of answer to to what I conceive to be the central problem of our culture, namely what it is we're going to be about. And to put it in Lutheran terms, I'd say, what's the content of the law? And I do think that we need a revolution, because if you don't have a self-conscious doctrine of the law and what the law demands of you, kind of, in terms of what does it mean to love, concretely, institutionally, what does it mean to love? If you don't have a doctrine, what you do is to follow the doctrine of the culture. And it seems to me that's what Christians have done. Christians, without the content of the law, they've either made the law very personal, but they've had, or they've adopted the law of the culture. But there's been no self-conscious doctrine of how institutions embody love. One of the ways to do it is to say they don't. And I think that's to avoid the issue. So two revolutions are necessary then. The first is a revolution in control, and it's a continuation really of what Tillich calls the Protestant era. It's an extension of self-initiation to those who have been excluded from the society because they have no significant role in the decision-making process. The second corresponds to Tillich's notion of the Catholic substance. It's a revolution in ends, or what I call the substance. Now, the third revolution seems to me to follow from these first two, and it has to do with the institutionalization. What institution, both symbolically and actually, is going to take the lead in these two revolutions? Now, I think, really, that the church should. That's been a real concern for me, and I've been involved in some effort to do this within the church structure for at least 30 years. And I see no possibility, really, of much happening within the present church structure, partly because the present church membership, for the most part, seems to think, I don't know about Lutheran Church, but I know about a number of others, the present membership seems to think that religion and politics are divorced. And I say we ought to return to the Old Testament. A religious institution ought to be an institution which in some sense embodies the religious substance as well as the political means. And that's really a great shift if it occurs. That's why it's really a sudden radical change. I'm not sudden, but it would be a radical change. Revolution is, you know, sudden, complete, a radical change. It really would be a radical change. But I just came to this conclusion when I had to give this talk for Divinity School students. It occurred to me suddenly, right in the midst of writing the thing, that's what we ought to do. You know how those things come to you? You live for years and you don't come to that conclusion. You fight it, and all of a sudden you think, wowie. The Old Testament had this unity. We have said that Christianity has taken the good away from the state, and there's a book by Cochrane, Charles Cochrane, on Christianity and classical culture. It says what Christianity did was to revolutionize the concept of the good. Where the Greeks thought the state was responsible for informing culture with the good, Christianity said the church was, and all responsibility for the good was taken away from the state. And that's what Christianity has done. Now, if he's right, and I think he really is right, that I'm asking for a complete revolution, for a return to the Old Testament notion. I think in part this change in view of where the good is located occurred because there's a heavy emphasis in the New Testament, it seems to me at least, and I've read the thing, you know, almost in one sitting trying to figure out what are they doing for society, what are they saying about society. I think in part it is because the kingdom of God, it seems to me in the New Testament, in spite of what some people say here and other places, tends to be a kingdom of God which has to do not with history. Now, I know that that will raise some questions, so let me drop that for the moment. But it does seem to me that the Old Testament has both a kingdom which is above history and a kingdom in history. I have a sermon that I preach to black congregations, which comes out of Deuteronomy 11, which says, "Go in and take possession of the promise." Take possession. And that's exactly what the Hebrews did. They went in and took possession. And that's why it's hard for me to be a pacifist, I guess. I can appreciate it. But I think I really believe, in a sense, that those who think they embody, I know there are problems, they only think they embody, but the problem of divorcing the substance of religion from politics seems to me to have been tragic. I think that's what we've done. So what I'm really advocating, and this is kind of a trial balloon, you see, the new ideas with me. It's not new in history because it's in the Old Testament. It's new for me. And I have all kinds of papers and documents in which I say the church ought not to do this kind of thing. So I'm aware of the problem. So it seems to me we've got to institutionalize the two revolutions, and we've got to get them embodied so that the community of religion and politics are united. So we need a program then for American institutions built upon a qualification and subordination of the present religious substance, that is, the faith in production and control, to another substance which I call union and enjoyment. And we need an organization focusing upon that development. Now there are persons in and groups in and out of the synagogues, churches, and parishes that might be united in a new history-bearing movement, a retrieve, if you will, of the dimensions of Israel. Then religion, that is the substance, would be a public affair. And for the next period, public affairs would be informed by and controlled by a religious vision and by those who embody it. In other words, it'd be a government by the saints. And I know all the problems of trying to locate the saints. Except me and thee, and sometimes not even thee. Now, it just occurred to me after I'd given this thing for our students, the substance of this, without all the Lutheran references, it occurred to me that I really thought there should be a fourth revolution. And the fourth one has to do with education. You see, I've applied to the church, And now in politics, kind of mixed them up. Now in education. And I think that education in the next period has got to include the client in decision making. That is the student. Now I know there'll be risks in this. I'm aware of the risks because I've worked with students and I literally put four students from our little department, which they call Ethics and Society, and a decision-making role, and four students and four faculty make all the decisions in our little department. Who gets in, who gets scholarships, everything. Faculty retain official control, because if we didn't, we'd have the whole university against us, and if they knew what we were doing, they'd be against us anyway. But I've experienced this, and nobody who was in the group this year, very responsible, most responsible administration that department we've had in the 22 years I've been there, because the students were there. Really, because the students were there. But none of them wants to serve next year. It's too much time. It takes a lot of time and energy. So I'm aware of all the problems. Yeah, I'm not suggesting something that's utopian and that I don't know anything about, and therefore I'm suggesting it. But in spite of that, it seems to me, I always say to my classes, students ask the right questions. They don't have any better answers for some of these questions. The faculty have old questions and old answers. Now that's a kind of shorthand explanation. But I think it's true. I think faculty tend to teach what they know about, whether it's important or not. And certainly whether it's important to students or not, most of them teach it. I mean, the students are the last to be considered in some way. Now, that isn't always true. I'm sure Paul teaches differently, and so do I, of course. But I went into a course last year, and I said, now, what do you want to know and why? That's the first question. Well, that's what do you do with that? The problem is you ought to start over Narnia to ask the question, what do you want to do and why? So by the time you got to a college, you would have asked this question, you'd have your own agenda. And you come into a college with an agenda, and you look for some faculties that can help you with your agenda, and they may help you reshape it. But you have an agenda. That's why I really like Friedman's notion in part. In part, I like it about giving everybody a voucher and saying, you go to the school you want. You know, he says, give everybody a voucher, and it's good for a certain number of dollars in any school. Then the school's got to compete for the students, and the students have to. Now, I know there's some problems, and the faculty would say, students don't know what they want, they don't know what an education is, and they are not interested in the school and so forth, and I've got a whole little diatribe on that. But I think the important thing is that young people who are asking questions, partly in reaction, will force other people, if they're given participation in certain kinds of things, and I don't say they should have participation in everything, although I can't think for the moment what they shouldn't have participation in, will help reshape education to deal with the substance that I'm talking about. Because I think young people, for the most part, and I know a lot of them aren't, but for more young people are asking more significant questions than older people. There's just no question about that. Now, the second thing that ought to happen in education is that it ought to be organized to permit a search for new values, for this new values. That is, it ought to begin, and particularly in the social sciences and humanity, with a goal, and not with something theory. We've got so much knowledge about the city of Chicago that it's buried, you know, they've got to build bigger libraries to hold it, but it hasn't helped much, I say, in doing something about Chicago. And we ought to begin with questions that are being asked and things that are important. We started a seminar last year on the future of America. And really, the question is so big, and we don't know how to handle it, and it doesn't fit in the neat categories where we've been teaching. We don't know what to do with it. And we have stumbled and bumbled for two quarters. And I don't know when it is we'll ever, you know, settle down and find it, but I think we're asking the right questions. Now, I'm the most insecure as a teacher in that seminar that I am anywhere. I can go in with a set of lectures, you know, and you feel secure at least, even if the people don't listen. You've got something to say, but if you go in here and you don't have anything to say because you don't know quite how to tackle it, you really are anxious, and you sweat it out, and you're glad when the damn seminar is over, because you really don't know. Now, I think we've got to get our education. Just take the ecological crisis, for example, as one example. Now, some schools are beginning to tackle that question, but the way you tackle it is to get some faculty who are already overloaded to do this in addition. They're not going to give credit for that, certainly. But one of the girls who was up here, Louise, what's her name, Thorson, taught a course last year this way, but it was an extra course. Those important questions need to be tackled by the university. The third thing is to do away with this infinite adolescence I've been talking about, and to get students involved in the world before old age. I think that young people should be acting politically, and they ought to be in significant roles, certainly by the time they're 16. And I think by the time you're in college, I think one ought to be going to school and doing something. Now, one of the problems is if you don't know what to do, you got a problem if the institutions aren't addressing the problems you think are important. It is a problem. It's not a simple kind of thing, but I've experimented with this. I'm not talking about things. I've experimented with students who have graduated from college, and they come to the divinity school, and then we have to start this process of putting them out in the world where things are going on and relating them to significant things so they can begin to ask questions and function. And in significant situations, students have become alive. And I think we ought to start that earlier. Now, I don't know whether that's a radical reordering of education, but in the light of what goes on in our school, I think it's quite a significant change. So these four revolutions are what I think are important today, tomorrow maybe five or three. And I only have one thing to conclude with, and that's a kind of a caution. I don't know how you get the faith to live with a situation where you don't have the answer. Tillich once said that what we have now is a sacred void. He tried in Germany with what he called a religious socialist movement, which is a misnamed movement, but at any rate, which was concerned with the religious substance of society to provide an alternative to Hitler. But it failed. And it was a religious political movement. And I think that's what we need today. But there isn't any. And so what do? He said, well, all we can do is to live with a sacred void. It's a void because we do not know where to go. It's sacred because we believe we'll find a place to go, a direction. And we'll avoid it more if we can avoid jumping on the wrong idolatrous bandwagon and have the faith to wait and listen and try and struggle and be content with little things while we think about big things. And so we can wait patiently with hope and without despair, because we really do believe in some way that the kingdom of God is not only imminent but transcendent. And that patient, hopeful, waiting, searching is, in God's eyes, his imperative for us. Well, that's what I'm about, I think. I have a couple of students now, one of whom is working in the Oak Park family life situation and with transactional analysis. And he was in our group, and that's where I had to learn transactional analysis, because they were so involved in it. And he has a drug addiction program. He's really struggling with what you do about drug addiction daily in all kinds of group therapy with young people and their families and so forth. So when he studies religion and personality, or he studies something about social organization, he's trying, you know, to see what that means in terms of some very, very concrete ministry. Ministry in the broadest sense of the word. That is, he's ministering in the name of his faith and trying to deal with these realities.